Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Rates and Lanes with Rico Mohammed. This is the show where we improve your knowledge of the freight market, improve your bottom line, and improve the transportation industry as a whole. We're talking Rates and Lanes. Let's move on down the audio road.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am your host, Rico Mohammed, and this is the Rates and Lanes podcast. We are experiencing some slight technical difficulties, so I'm going to need y'all to bear with me just a little bit. We're trying to get Hank Seaton back on board. My computer today seems to be on its last leg. I think I'm going to have to replace the hard drive in this thing, so it's moving really crazy. So I'm trying to get Hank back up on board with us. And while we're waiting on Hank to get back in, we'll just start off as we normally do with this week's USDA fruit and vegetable truck rate. Now, we will have this report posted up for you if we can get some issues resolved. We'll have it up for you on the Rates and Lanes podcast Facebook page for you, for your viewing pleasure. But this week's report, we don't have any markets that are showing any types of shortages right now currently as of today when this report came out a little earlier today. But we have several markets that are showing slight shortages, and those markets are Central and South Florida. And as we've been talking about over the past few podcasts, when we talk about Florida, you know, it's always got a little caveat to it because it's still kind of like the Roach Motel. You may be able to go in, make sure you got something set up before you go down there. If you're working the spot market, you may be able to get you a nice run out of there. You may get down there and get stuck and come out of there barely wearing your shirt. So always proceed with a little caution. Make sure you got something lined up before you get into Florida. Vidalia District, Georgia, we have slight shortages being reported. Eastern North Carolina, we have slight shortages being reported. Lower Rio Grande Valley, Texas, watermelons are starting to move. Slight shortage on that end. And also Mexico crossing through Texas. Slight shortages being shown there. Areas that you might want to proceed with some caution. Florida, once again, showing a slight surplus of trucks. I know I just said that we had some trucks that were showing a slight shortage, but we actually have a little bit of a slight surplus as well in parts of Florida. Columbia Basin, Washington is reporting a slight surplus of trucks. Yakima Valley and Winchie District, Washington, is also reporting a slight plus of trucks. Areas that are reporting an outright surplus of trucks, and this is a little bit unusual. I think this is the first time I've ever seen this. Central Wisconsin is reporting a outright surplus of trucks in the area right now. So that, ladies and gentlemen, wrap up this week's USDA truck and fruit and vegetable truck rate report. We're going to jump right over into this week's DAT report and let's see here. And so you guys got to bear with me just a little bit because I'm operating on a little bit of a different platform because my computer is not cooperating with me at all. Ah, there we go. So this week's DAT National Dry Van and Capacity Report for the week of May 7th through the 13th. Nationally, both load posts and truck posts increased by 1% last week, caused the load-to-truck ratio to hold steady at 3.3 loads per truck. The national average van rate slipped by 2 cents per mile last week compared to the previous week. Van loads postings declined by 5% in April compared to March. Truck posts declined 12% during that same time span, which led to an 8% overall increase in the national load-to-truck ratio at 3.5 van loads per truck. The ratio was up 127% from where it was the same time in April of 2016. Right now, the national load-to-truck ratio for dry vans is sitting at 3.3 loads per truck nationally. Let's take a look and see how the rates were performing for dry vans. Give me just a second. Got to figure out how to work my mojo on my little iPad here. We're not able to do it on my computer, so we're trying to work it through the iPad. Let's see here. Although van rates increased in several top freight markets last week, the national average spot market rate slipped 2 cents to $1.68 per mile. On average, van rates increased in Atlanta and Houston, but fell in Columbus and Allentown, PA. The national average price for diesel last week dropped by 2 cents, down to a national average of $2.54 per gallon. The national average van rate increased by 4 cents in April compared to March. At $1.67 per mile, the national van rate was 17 cents higher than it was the same time of April of 2016. Moving right along, jumping over into the flatbed load-to-truck ratio of national demand and capacity report. Flatbed load postings declined by 3%, while truck postings increased by the load-to-truck ratio to decline by 6%, down to 36.9 loads per truck. The national average flatbed rate slipped lower last week compared to the previous week. Compared to March, flatbed load postings rose 3% in April, while the truck postings declined by 14%. That pushed the load-to-truck ratio up by 19% from 36.6 to 43.7 loads per truck nationally. Compared to April of 2016, the ratio has soared by 102%. Let's take a look and see how those flatbed rates were performing on the spot market. We have spot market flatbed rates dipped 1 cent last week to a national average of $2.08 per mile. Dropped to $2.08 per mile. Hold on 1 second, ladies and gentlemen. Got a customer coming up to me. All right, I apologize about that. Ladies and gentlemen, we over here loading up at a customer trying to get ready. Jumping back into this flatbed report, flatbed rates increased by 4%, by 4 cents in April compared to March. The national average of $2.07 per mile was 17 cents higher than it was in April of 2016. The national average, I'm just all off kilter tonight. Let's go back. I got to give you guys the rates from around the country for the flat, for the dry van. So let's get back to the dry van report. Starting out around the country, we try to break this thing down regionally, trying to get my mojo back. The technical difficulties kind of throwing me off a little bit, so I do apologize for that. But starting off in the Northeast Corridor for dry vans, the spot market rate shows $1.65 per mile. Dropping down into the southeastern portion of the United States, we have Atlanta, Georgia checking in, showing spot market rates at $1.95 per mile. We have, moving into the Midwest, Chicago, Illinois checking in, spot market rates for dry vans at $1.88 per mile. Moving down into the south central portion of the United States, we have Dallas, Texas checking in, showing average spot market rates of $1.61 per mile. And moving over to the West Coast, Los Angeles, California, leading the pack, showing a healthy market for dry vans at $2.01 per mile on average coming out of Los Angeles. All right, now jumping back over into the flatbed rates on the spot market nationally by regions, starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States, we have $3.64 leading the pack coming out of the northeast, out of Harrisburg, PA. Jumping down into the southeast, we have Atlanta, Georgia coming in at $2.66 per mile on the spot market for flatbeds. Moving up into the Midwest, Rock Island, Illinois checking in, showing spot market rates at $0.55 per mile. Jumping down into the south central portion of the United States, Houston, Texas checking in, showing $2.38 per mile coming out of Houston on the spot market for flatbeds. And wrapping up the flatbed rate report out of the West Coast, Phoenix, Arizona is the representative city, showing spot market rates for flatbeds at $1.99 per mile. Let's jump over, trying to get our bearing back, looking at the national reefer demand and capacity report for the week of May 7th through the 13th. Last week, reefer load postings declined by 1%, while truck postings increased 5%. That caused the load-to-truck ratio to decline 6% to 6.1 loads per truck. The national average spot market rate for reefers moved higher last week compared to the previous week. And taking a look back historically, reefer load postings declined 5% in April compared to March. Truck postings declined 11%, which caused the load-to-truck ratio to increase by 6% from 6.2 up to 6.6 loads per truck. Compared to April of 2016, the load-to-truck ratio has skyrocketed by 134%. Now, let's go and take a look and see how U.S. reefer rates were performing on the spot market for the week of May 7th through the 13th. The national average rate for reefer rate increased 2 cents last week to $1.99 per mile nationally. That's the highest weekly rate average in the past 4 months. Taking a look nationally around the country, starting out in the northeastern corridor, Elizabeth, New Jersey checks in, showing average spot market rates for reefers at $1.63 per mile. Dropping down into the southeastern portion of the United States, Lakeland, Florida checking in, showing reefer rates at $2.14 per mile. Jumping up into the Midwest, Green Bay, Wisconsin checking in, showing average spot market rates for reefers at $2.66 per mile. Going down into the Rio Grande, McAllen, Texas, that's south central portion of the United States, checking in, showing average spot market rates for reefers at $2.08 per mile. And wrapping up with the West Coast, $2.14 per mile coming out of Fresno, California. And let's see, we're going to try to grab Hank, and we're going to try, and we're probably going to have to do this live on air. If I can get the computer to cooperate, and I'm not so sure it is going to cooperate. Let's see here. We got it. This is going to be my first time trying this, the way that I'm trying to do it. I'm not sure if that's going to work. All right, let's try it this way. Yeah, I'm trying to see. I'm doing it a little bit differently. I'm having some technical difficulties on my end. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can hear me, and Hank is on the call with me, we're doing it a little bit differently tonight because we're having some technical difficulties. If somebody could shoot me a text message and let me know that y'all can hear me, that we're still on the air, that would be greatly appreciated. So we're trying. I'm having some problems with, I think I got a hard drive that's getting ready to crash on me, Hank, and my computer is just kind of toast right now. But I think that we're good. I think that we're good. I got some thumbs up. I think that we're good. So tonight, Hank, like we talked about a little earlier, we're still seeing a lot of brokers that are trying to write some stuff, different stuff in, and incorporate some stuff in with the Food Safety and Modernization Act. I sent you a couple of things over earlier in the week.
Yes, you did.
Just want to kind of go back and elaborate on how important it is to make sure that, you know, I try to explain this to people sometimes. Sometimes, I guess in layman's terms, people really don't really grasp the seriousness and the weight that this is going to cause if something was to go bad. Like I always say, you know, it's never a problem until it's a problem. And when it's a problem, it's a little bit too late to be dealing with it then.
Yeah, you're right. It's unfortunate, but everybody's trying to blame the FDA for messing up transportation. But that is really not the case. The FDA rules are really fairly simple to implement, and they're intended to ensure that sanitary food is delivered and no one gets sick. They are not intended to change cargo claims or to change the relationship principally between the shipper and the broker on one hand and the carrier on the other. What has happened is what we had feared, which is that the shipper community is taking FSMA as the excuse to put the extra nail in the coffin of the small carrier with respect to cargo claims. Whoever is on the phone, I would ask you, do you know what your cargo insurance provides? My guess is that there is no one on the phone who has cargo insurance to cover the pernicious things that are being put in shipper and broker contracts. What we're seeing, what RICO has sent to me, what my large and small carriers report, is that the shippers are now saying that they need the sole discretion to decide when to trash foodstuffs. They're saying in the contract that if there's a broken seal, they've got the discretion to trash it. They're saying in the contract that their decision is final and that you will pay the freight claim. All of those requirements, although they'll put in there that you've got to comply with all of these different regulations, none of what they're asking of you is really required by FSMA or the Food Safety Modernization Act. With respect to cargo claims, as opposed to being sure that you've got a sanitary trailer and you've got a reefer and that you've got some food safety training, all of the things about the cargo are just simply not there. In fact, the FSMA rules say that before a shipment that could have been contaminated, you don't know, you think it is, before it can be sold for human consumption, it must be inspected. That is really nothing new. The cargo insurance that you have, let's assume that it's just not reefer breakdown. Let's assume it's the best you can get. It is going to cover you so long as your insurer has the right to inspect. The shipper has an obligation to mitigate the damages, and there's some determination of the salvage value. those three elements, the right to inspect, the obligation to reasonably mitigate the damage, and to determine whether or not the goods have a salvage value, are the three underpinnings of your insurance that these contracts want to take away and blame the federal government for it. That is not the law. So that brings us into the protocol that we talked about last time, and the reason we have tried to give carriers some pushback to say, look, we warrant we'll comply with the law, but now the cargo claim is something else. From your perspective, if you get one of these crammed down contracts that waive mitigation, that waive salvage, and waive inspection, you need to go ask your insurance company, listen, somebody on a blog said, I don't have coverage for that. Is that true? Because if you just trust your insurance company, you're in for a real bad hair day. If you just very simply sign that, you are assuming an uninsured risk to the extent of any broken seal and any amount that the shipper wants to bill you. Now, my concern for small carriers is when you outrun your insurance, one bad claim can ruin your year. There may be big shippers, big carriers rather, and big brokers who can goose up their margin enough to cover the time it happens. But you got to figure they're basically acting like the casino. They got enough transactions that they can lose a bunch and still make money. The small man with two or three trucks can't afford to take that uninsurable risk. And that's the nature of the problem, and that's why, you know, I have suggested that there be pushback to it. One other thing that I have to tell you, I was at a conference in the past 2 months, and I listened to two attorneys that do this, and they both represent very large brokers, and I was overwhelmed at their apparent lack of concern for the carriers that the brokers worked with. They said, and this is basically a paraphrase, it's unfortunate that the shippers are demanding that, but that's business and we're going to have to demand it from our carriers, and we know that there's some of them that will just simply go out of business. Now, you know, from my point of view, I know a lot of good brokers who don't want to accept more liability than they can reasonably expect to get from the carriers because they value their reputation with the carrier. So, you know, your option is, do you sign something that could put you out of business? Do you say no thank you? You say I'm a member of the protocol, that's as far as I'm going to go. You've got to make that risk assessment. From my point of view, a small guy is not in a position to run the risk of one of these obnoxious offsets. And, you know, I'm sure people on the line will have examples of it, even down to the one I gave last month where a load of bottled water was rejected because it had been on the truck too long. Really, it wasn't delivered within 3 days, and the shipper wanted to crush the whole load. There needs to be some reasonable standard to judge cargo claims by. That's what your cargo insurance expects, and that's what you need to expect. So that's enough of a monologue. Rico, why don't you ask me questions about that?
I'd be
happy to go over this. I put too much legalese in it.
Well, no, the main thing is that I try to get across to a lot of people, and you can correct me if I'm off base on this, but the main thing that I try to explain is that once you are in business or a business person, then you are kind of expected to be a little bit more savvier or a little bit more educated, and therefore, when it comes to different things with law terms and contracts and things of that nature, by you being in business, then you have to, it's your responsibility to look out for your own best interest. And it's not like being a consumer where you got certain consumer protections. When you're dealing with a business-to-business application, what we're in, then it's dog-eat-dog, and it's every dog for himself, as far as I understand it. And do I have the right understanding of how that works?
Yeah, look, you know, there is nothing illegal about a shipper demanding you to assume an unreasonable risk. It's just stupid on your part if you do it. And when you become a carrier, all of a sudden you become accountable for making a profit. Nobody's guaranteeing you that that all you got to do is show up at work and get paid. You've got the risk of having to make your equipment payments. You've got the risk of having your equipment break down if it's not serviced at the right time. And risk assessment, the term risk assessment, is something that is at the highest level of large carriers. They have risk loss managers, and it's their job to be sure that they're reasonably insured for the perils of the business they're in. You know, I'm a lawyer. I have never had a malpractice suit, but I have malpractice insurance coverage for that. You know, it's just a question of, you know, your insurer probably tried to sell you insurance for everything. The big goof here with small carriers is most of them really don't understand what their cargo insurance covers. And what I'm pointing out is it certainly doesn't cover what shippers are trying to claim FSMA requires.
And I wanted to kind of make that, I wanted to make that point, you know, try and connect a couple of dots, not only with this FSMA piece that we're talking about, Hank, but I also wanted to connect the dots all the way across the board as far as our industry is concerned when it comes to even buying a tractor. And you hear people talk about, you know, well, I want a newest truck because I want to get a warranty. And you know how that, you know, all this stuff is contracts and legalese and how all of that stuff plays into one another. And if you don't do your homework and do your due diligence to make sure that you are making the turn that you said, that you are making the proper risk assessment of what you're getting into, there is nobody that's coming to save you and protect you and say, oh, that's not right. They shouldn't have done that. That if you hadn't done that on the front end, then you kind of screwed yourself.
Yeah, and you know what you've got to look at is if you are a small carrier, you've got the same risk, the same duties, and the same obligations as Swift or anybody else. You are an entrepreneur. You're going to get the tax breaks as a result, but you've got to be a businessman. And, you know, that's not to say that you have to have an MBA from Harvard to do it, but you have to be conscious of what your risk and operating are. You have to get good advice, and you need to watch what you sign. Now, a lot of you guys were probably came up as owner-operators, and you remember as owner-operators there was this leasing regulation. And the leasing regulation didn't really keep you from getting screwed by the carrier, but it did contain certain things, like they had to pay you interest on your escrow. They had to settle with you in 14 days. They couldn't offset something they didn't put in writing. There was a whole bunch of legislation and regulations to protect you somewhat as an independent contractor. But those things don't really exist now that you got your name on the door. Now the buck stops with you in terms of insurance. The buck stops with you in terms of cargo claims. It stops with you in terms of safety. So all of those things, it stops with you in terms of being sure if you're running Jersey that you got that your license there. There's a lot that you have got to do. I'm not trying to encourage anybody on the phone from being an entrepreneur. Everybody who's got their name on a trucking company, be it Werner or Hunt or whoever it is, 30 years ago started exactly where you are. And the ones that I know weren't MBAs, and they just had an entrepreneurial spirit, and they grew. So I'm not trying to talk anybody out of the business. I'm just saying that I have great angst when I see a small guy who has to factor his receivables, has a broker offset a bogus cargo claim, and his factor closes him down, and then he calls me and says, "What can I do?" And I look at the contract he signed, and I see that he signed away his coverage. His insurance company's run from him, and I read the policy, and they're not going to cover something they can't inspect or mitigate, and they're just going to decline. That's going to decline coverage. You're sitting here for 6 months without money, without a factor. That quickly can draw a small man down. Where, you know, if you're big enough, hey, you can play the cash flow game maybe prevail, or otherwise hope to make it up on volume. But a small guy can't. And so, you know, that's why, particularly now that this is coming down pat, we're so anxious to get the word out that the 39,000 identifiable small carriers with less than three or four trucks in the refrigerated market. They represent a big portion of the industry, they need not to be taken advantage of.
Okay, Hank. Well, I'm working on some other stuff here real quickly. Tell us some other stuff that's coming down the pipe that we might need to be aware of out of nationally, out of D.C.
Well, I mean, all you got to do is turn on the TV and figure that any agenda we had hoped that would help the small people or help competition in terms of eliminating regulations or draining the swamp is probably on hold. There are a couple of things that the initiatives the current administration started. One was that they'd have to remove two regulations for every new regulation they put in. And number two, they put a hold on any regulation that wasn't finalized. Although that's off to a good start, the agency seems to be continuing on its own way. It does not have an administrator yet, and the career bureaucrats are still minding the store. They're still trying to modify SMS methodology on the safety side. They're still acting much more like prosecutors than they are objective auditors. Among the proposals they tabled is to do away with the new carrier audit, which, you know, you might initially say, well, gee, that was just a headache. Why is that a bad idea? Well, it's a bad idea because when it comes to your insurance premium, one thing that you have got is you pass the new carrier audit, so the insurance company is going to say, well, they've been vetted and maybe they're entitled to a halfway decent rate. If they were to remove the new carrier audit, and if they were to continue along the line that the vast majority of carriers are going to have no safety rating, then the insurance companies are going to continue to be skittish about the market for the small carrier. I think I'll just throw out numbers, and somebody on the question and answer wants to talk about it, they can. I believe that the small carriers are probably paying somewhere north of $12,000 to $18,000 a unit a year for BI and PD and cargo. I think that the large carriers could very easily have a $7,000 or $8,000 advantage on you in terms of cargo insurance costs. They can buy better insurance. They can buy it cheaper. They can get in pools. That's a big competitive disadvantage. I suppose, and I know that a lot of carriers have a hard time when it comes to renewal, even finding carrier insurance companies that will insure it. And I'm not going to name names, but some of the people that make the market are substandard in terms of their coverage. They have no loyalty to the small carrier. They'll cancel you if you have a wreck, regardless of fault. So we see the repercussions of the agency's action in the cost you pay for insurance and the availability of insurance. So all of those are things that if we were serious about reforming the agency, we could look at doing. Things like getting conflicting state laws off your back so that you've only got one standard to meet, not a different standard in each state. Things like seeing that you get a fair chance at safety, and we deal with these cargo problems. There are a bunch of issues. SMS is still around. Sometime next month, there'll be a National Academies of Science report on it, and that may heat up. The ELD, I think, is still on target to come in. There'll be a phase-in period. I don't know that the agency can get their act together by December, but that's not being held up. As we said before, the cost of a compliant ELD is not the issue. It's the problem that you'll have when there's no second logbook and the shipper demands on-time delivery and you're out of hours. I just was looking at a contract today for a client, and it had in the first paragraph, time is of the essence. In the sixth paragraph, it said, if you don't deliver it on the delivery time, we can deduct any surcharge the consignee wants to charge. Well, you know, all of that is really kind of forcing you to violate the law to speed and penalizing you out of the kazoo if you don't get there at time, where there wasn't a single provision in there for detention of your vehicle if they didn't unload you within 2 hours. So there are a whole lot of things that we could possibly do to level the competition by putting some standards in. This agency is not going to do that for you. They don't understand that the National Transportation Policy says they're supposed to administer the laws so that privately held carriers have an opportunity to compete and prosper. So there are ways maybe we could address that if we got the right support and industry got together. That's something we'll be looking at over the next year, but frankly, I'm pessimistic about Congress before or after Trump doing anything that gives us particular relief.
Okay, you guys, I've been worked out to the point to where now I am able to take phone calls. If you guys got questions, if you want to ask a question, you can go ahead and press the number one, figure out a way to try to get in there and backdoor this thing so we can take a couple of calls if anybody has any questions. Tying your things back up, going back around to the back door, well, to the front door, so to speak. Like I was saying earlier, Hank, the reason that it's great that we have you on board with us, and I just wanted to do my talks with everybody that I bump into when we have different discussions, when it just comes down to simple things as making sure that your name, the carrier of record on the bill of lading, from all this other stuff when I'm talking to different motor carriers or one truck or guys, you know, one or two trucks with their own authority operating out here. I see a bunch of people just really don't have a good clue when it comes to the legalities of what it is that they're signing. And it's like, well, that's not that much of a big deal. That's what my insurance is for. And just like you stated at the top of the hour, many of us haven't even took the time to really read and understand exactly what that cargo coverage provides for us and how big of a risk that we're actually putting ourselves in our business and our livelihoods in. So I just wanted to, you know, glad that you could kind of hammer that point on back home for us and maybe, you know, hopefully we can save.
Yeah, on the insurance thing, you know, in the little book that you know, your members have got a discount for, the rules of the road, I go over loopholes in cargo insurance, and they are there. As a lawyer, I have a difficult time looking at a cargo policy with the affirmative additions and subtractions, getting out what are they really trying to say. The insurance companies don't make it clear. If it were products liability applied the same way it does for consumer products, they couldn't sell it. If it were a legend drug, they'd have disclaimers coming out the wazoo on it. I suggest that you go to whatever agent sold you the insurance policy with some very pointed questions. List for me any commodity that's excluded. Tell me, am I covered if a load is stolen? Tell me, do I have, what are the exclusion for coverage? Does it exclude wetness, dampness, and moisture? If I'm in flatbed, is there an untarped load exclusion? Tell me in simple language, and then tell me who at the underwriter is going to help me look at contracts where people want something other than general principles of federal transportation law. Because remember, for over 100 years, if you don't sign a contract, what you're liable for is what's called the Carmack Amendment. You've always got to limit your liability to whatever the amount of your insurance is. If you got $100,000 worth of cargo, don't sign a contract unless you limit it to it. You could very well get a cargo claim for $500,000 in, and you owe it. Any insurance company or agent worth their salt will help you understand what coverage you have. And, you know, I can pretty well tell you, based upon your insurance people, what coverage you have. If you run up on a stump trying to get that done, I think that we've got my name on the Rates and Lanes webpage and the email address. I'll be happy to help you with it. But you know, your liability, if you've got BI and PD, you got FISDAM, you don't have the problems with those that you've got with cargo. You just need to know what your coverage is, and don't outrun your coverage.
Great point. I think that we have, let's see here, get back over here. We had someone that has a question. Don't think my daughter got a chance to screen them yet. We're going to grab them real quickly. Caller that's calling in from the 316 area code, you're up live with Rico and Hank. What's your name and how can we help?
Rico, it's Bruce Jansen. How are you guys this evening?
Great, Bruce. We're working through some technical issues, but we made it. We're flying without a net here. So we live radio, as they say.
You don't have a safety. You don't have a parachute on either, then, do you?
No, sir.
Hank, dispel a couple truck stop Facebook rumors that I see going around regarding ELDs. And, you know, I see people saying once I'm at my destination and my drive time is up, I'm out of hours, they can't force me to leave their property. Officers can't ask me to move if I'm on my break. You know, I can't be forced to do this or that. What? I think I know the answer, but honestly, you know, are these people just blowing smoke or are they actually telling the truth?
It is kind of a Mexican standoff, is the best way to say it. Obviously, your ELD is going to record an incremental move. You know, if the guy is just obnoxious and he tells you you've got to get off your lot, I think I would probably footnote my log. customer force me to move. I'm not saying that, you know, that get you a get-out-of-jail-free card, but if the FMCSA comes in to audit you, and what they're doing now is they are coming in and asking to see the people that are on ELDs, and they run a little computer program and trying to find them based on it. I think at that point that if you moved it off the lot yet you were still on private property, I'd be more than happy to defend you if you were forced to move. It is true that when you get high-handed response from a shipper or a broker, you should now have more negotiating tools to tell them, look, buddy, you know, I'm going to be out of hours unless you unload me and give me at least immediately and give me a less 30 minutes to get off the lot, or you're going to have to be looking at me because I got to take my 10 hours and I don't want to tie up your dock. I mean, you know, you can kind of blame the regulations to try to get out ahead of that. But I'm not sure that some of the dock people are going to accept that. And, you know, if they call a county mountie and tell you you're trespassing, he's probably not going to understand it either. So I guess what I'm saying is I haven't seen it tried. It is true that when you're out of hours, you're out of hours, and you're and the system is calibrated to even pick up when you have to move at 5 miles. It is that kind of specificity that has caused most people who are concerned about the ELD to say that in terms of getting miles and getting home, they think that for planning purposes, they're going to see as much as an 8% to 12% reduction in productivity. So that's most people's informed concern about what's going to happen is, how do I get compensated for downtime? You know, I'm losing flexibility. Somebody doesn't get me off in 30 minutes. The next guy wants a time delivery. I can't build all that fudge factor into it. If everybody wants time deliveries and the agency says, I haven't got the time, that's going to be a problem for those of us in truckload. One of the things that is happening is this whole Amazon effect. All of the large carriers are now trying to develop last-mile services so that the idea of using truckloads to make stop truckload carriers to make stop-offs seems to be somewhat not favored anymore. There are a number of factors on truckload. You know, this crazy thing about overtime, shippers' demands for visibility. They want to know where you are every hour of the day. The changing demographics so that you don't deliver to a regional warehouse. They're looking at, particularly in retail, breaking it up into LTL shipments over a cross dock. All of those things, I think, in the next 5 years are probably going to have their effect on the truckload industry. Certainly some things are not going to change, but as Amazon has quickly proven, the idea that you're going to be delivering to a distribution center and then they run their own trucks out to make one delivery a week to the store doesn't seem to be the model of the future. So I know I've rambled a bit, but I've heard that kind of truck stop talk before, and I've heard that people use it as a basis to say, in your face, Mr. Shipper, I can't wait. You just can't close the doors and leave me here because I can't even get off your lot. Don't tell me to come back tomorrow. I'm out of hours. I don't have a straight up answer for you. I don't know that it's been litigated. I don't know whether fisticuffs have broken out or not. But I hear the same thing you do.
Well,
it's
going to
be interesting because I've had a situation myself where I was at a shipper and certain situation like that kind of happened, And the security guard was there, was like, well, we're going to call, if you're not moving off the property, we're going to call the police, and we're going to have you towed, or we're going to have you arrested or whatever. You know, it's all kind of crazy threats that are levied. And, you know, what do the you know, I know you probably don't have the best answer for us, Hank, but, I mean, you know, what's the small guy to do? Because, you know, they'll also, if you try and pull some of that stuff, then they, you know, you may be at a risk of being barred from the property, from ever being able to come back to the property again. And, you know, it's just a minefield of a whole bunch of stuff that you got to try to navigate as, you know, one truck trolley trying to provide for your family.
Well, you know, I understand that. I'm old enough to remember, and I, Lord knows, I don't want to be sound like I'm a re-regulator, but I remember when the shippers were so abusing carriers in terms of delivery that the ICC, who cared about competition, passed mandatory detention rules that says you've got 45 minutes to unload it. After that, you pay, I think back then it was $25 an hour, $6 a quarter hour or whatever to the carrier if you didn't unload him and he arrived during ordinary business hours. Now you think, how far have we come from that? Now we've got a shipper who doesn't want to run a third shift and doesn't want to have a lumper on site or enough doors to unload you when you arrive, who just thinks if you don't get there at 10:02, he can reject the load, tell you to come back in a week, and just say that's tough. Well, you know, at some point that's really abusive. And there'll be a tendency on the part of the people on the phone to say, well, I'm not big enough to push back. But, you know, you're obviously every day taking a risk, and I think it doesn't take people very long to realize what consignees are particularly abusive about it. So, you know, I guess you say, look, if you're going to send me to that dude, I'm going to either have to detention or we're going to have to goose up the load because I got another load going to Birmingham and there are people that are not expecting time deliveries and going to leave me at the dock all night. So, you know, information's power, but at the same time, I'm not suggesting we all collude to come up with detention, but I think you ought to think about negotiating that on the front end. And, you know, if you've got somebody that wants you to accept extraordinary liability or special duties or inside deliveries or whatever, you deserve to be compensated for it. You know, I've tried to write on this. There are people that write on it fairly frequently to alert small guys as to what those kinds of problems are. There are people large and small that are all over the lot in terms of how much risk they will accept. But, you know, as a lawyer, it's easy for me to say, toe the line. If you've got to get if you're going to be denied access to freight, you may be assuming risk, but at least know what they are and measure them going in.
All right. Bruce, you got anything else before we wrap up? We're getting close to that time.
Another quick question, and it came up in a discussion with a friend of mine who is bidding on contracts with a major shipper, and the shipper said if he's not 100% ELD compliant, he will not allow that person to bid on freight. At what point does the shipper or the customer's responsibility end for me operating my truck safely, and do they really, other than they're assuming they have that power, do they really have it? Or at what point does their liability end and mine start? Or is theirs overlap mine all the way?
Well, the question is, in a contract, since they can waive all commerce laws, they can say that you can't come on their dock unless you've got a tuxedo and a purple painted truck. That doesn't mean that there's any rhyme or reason to that. So basically, it's their freight. They get to dictate the terms and conditions. With respect to being ELD compliant, what they're obviously concerned about is them being sued if some carrier they hire has an accident and is going too fast or is violating the hours of service. The ELD is not going to change that. Somebody has told them that that the ELD rule is going to come in, that it's a safety rule, and that when it comes in, there are a lot of little guys that won't be compliant. There's one carrier that I will not name, but I know that they've gone to major shippers and told them all that the little guys won't be able to have the ELD, so don't put them out for bid. And they're trying to say, give us the business as a broker, and we'll put our own trucks on it, and we'll be sure that we're compliant with the new safety regulations. So there are people out here that are trying to say that little guys are renegades, they're not going to be able to have the ELD, and convince the shipper that the ELD is a safety monitoring system, and if you haven't got one, you haven't got one because you're not don't want to comply. Now, of course, there's a difference between an ELD, which reports to the your hours of service for compliance purposes, and what I'm seeing, which is MacroPoint and all of these tracking mechanisms where the shipper actually wants to have visibility and know where you are. Now, if a shipper puts in a contract that he wants visibility because he wants to be able to communicate with you using in-cab technology, you need to say that's the dumbest idea you ever came up with, because you certainly don't want to be controlling my driver.
Right.
You know, I'm involved in a lawsuit now in which the broker is being taken to task because he required MacroPoint to be on the truck, and the plaintiff's bar is just saying, well, look, you had the ability to see that that guy was out of hours. You had the ability to see that he was speeding, and you didn't even bother to check, did you? And then they come in and say, you know, I see this thing in the contract about him being an independent contractor and being solely responsible for safety, but actually you accepted that burden. You even required to micromanage him through MacroPoint.
Wow.
So, you know, there are two sides to that story. And I've done presentations on the idea that one man's visibility is another man's coercion. One thing that can be used to get back to our earlier discussion is there are now coercion rules that say that if a shipper directly tries to coerce a driver to violate the regulations, you can whistleblow and the company can be responsible for a penalty. So that might be something that you could use in the get off my lot argument. You could say, hey, look, buddy, I'm out of hours. I told you I was going to be out of hours. You can't force or coerce me to leave because I'll be in violation of the hours of service, and there's a coercion rule against that. So that's one thing, now that I think about it, that you might be able to use if they require you to move and you're out of hours. Usually we think about that coercion rule when a guy is getting loaded 4 hours later and says, look, man, I can't make Hunts Point by 10 a.m. And they say, well, you're loaded, buddy. That's your unloading time. Hit the road. Then, you know, that's what we think about is coercion. But I guess it could happen when he just says, get off my lot and you're out of hours.
I tell you, that is very interesting to see how entangled that web can be if you're not careful. Not only for us as motor carriers, but also how these brokers are going right back and creating that same vicarious liability that they were trying to avoid.
Well, the brokers are actually some of them are more sophisticated than that. What happens is their vendors of these visibility things that are allied members of the Brokers Association and everything else, and they won't put on seminars talking about visibility. And shippers are into visibility. You know, Amazon is doing it, and now everybody else is. If you go out and read today's trade mags, you'll see that Werner is offering a new program. It's white glove delivery, and it's matched together with some shipment tracking system. And, of course, what they're going to do is try to cut into the Amazon experience. It's one thing to track a shipment. It's another thing to have in-cab technology to talk to a truck driver. You know, there are a lot of benefits to Amazon and Uber because they're designing their systems based upon a clean piece of paper. RFID tracking of shipments is one thing. Being able to call a truck driver and say, why in the hell aren't you at the dock? Your appointment ends in 35 minutes is another thing.
Wow. Wow. Well, Hank, we definitely appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to come on board with us and share and impart us with a little bit of knowledge to try to get us a little better prepared for the world that we're facing out here as small guys, as motor carriers. Won't you tell everybody again, TransComply, I'll help out a little bit. TransComply is the website. If you want to get involved, if you are a food, if you're transporting any type of food, say foodstuffs, you need to get with TransComply and check them out at transcomply.com. Get involved with the protocol. It's a couple of little steps that you got to do. You know, you pay your fee and you make sure you go get your stuff notarized and everything. But it's really a really quick turnaround if you do what you need to do on your end to get your certifications. I'm definitely glad that I did. And I'm, like I said, still seeing a lot of stuff coming in from different brokers about this Food Safety and Modernization Act. So, Hank, won't you tell everybody how they can get in contact with you if they need any type of your services?
Yeah, my email is the easiest thing, just remember this, transportationlaw.net. That's .net, not .com. You can get my contact information there. Just to summarize what Rico's saying about the protocol, we are publishing the list of compliant carriers who warrant that they do the training and meet the basic requirements of FSMA. The value of that is in the vetting process when somebody wants to give you a load and says, well, you know, you need to sign all of my contract addendum, make all these warranties. You should say, look, I know all about food safety. I'm a signatory to this website. You can go and see that all my people are trained. You can see that I warrant that, I know what is involved in food safety training and that I will comply. So since I meet the minimum standards, you ought to be able to vet me with this and the fact that this website says I've got insurance and give me that load. So, I mean, you know, it's going to be kind of hard if somebody says, are you FSMA compliant? And you say, well, what's that? You're going to need to be able to say that you meet the minimum standards. And, you know, my desire is to convince more and more brokers to endorse it. Already we've got, people like KLM and Alan Lund endorsing that motor carriers should join it and trying to hold the line on that being the standard, not only for FSMA compliance, but also to not contaminate this cargo claims issue. So you can go to transcomply.com. Rico, you have that on your website, don't you?
Absolutely. We're going to repost it. We try to repost it every time you come on. And I just can't stress, even some Dropbox guys may even need to be a part of this. Cause I'm thinking about yesterday, Hank. I was making a delivery at a place up in North Carolina, and a guy with a Dropbox, he had a load of pickles. And it was a bad wreck that happened in North Carolina yesterday. And he said that, you know, he was trying to avoid a car or something pulled out in front of him. and he was trying to avoid the car. And the load, long story short, the load shifted on him, and the poor guy was sitting at the dock, pickle juice running all out of the Dropbox trailer, and stuff was everywhere. So I could only imagine what he was getting ready to be looking down the pike at as far as a claim is concerned. But, just to say that even as a Dropbox carrier with a full-grade trailer, you may want to you may fall under that rule as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah. The temperature is just one aspect of it. If it's not shelf-ready and if it's produce, there's a whole hell of a lot of produce that probably falls under FSMA that's just got vented back doors. So clearly, if you're hauling stuff that's fit for human consumption or dog food, you could very well fall under FSMA, but the shippers, when you sign that contract, aren't making that distinction. They're saying they want the right to reject, crush, and dump it. They say if it's a broken seal, they want to destroy it, and they'll destroy a load of a flour or oatmeal in bags just as quick as they will, something that has to be kept at 38 degrees. Because it could have been contaminated.
Absolutely. Well, Hank, like I said, we don't want to abuse your time. We appreciate you taking time out, coming on with us, and explaining and breaking some things down for us. We look forward to speaking with you again, same time next month.
That'll be great.
Yes, sir. This is Rico Muhammad signing off for the Rates and Lanes podcast. God willing, we'll see you guys and talk to you guys next week. We're working on some stuff to try and if I can get my technical stuff squared away. We might start trying to do some live video feeds for the show, but that's something that we'll work on right now. It was crazy tonight trying to get the technical stuff squared away. We finally got it squared away. We thank you guys for being patient with us. Thank you guys for the support. We'll see you next week. You guys be safe out there. God bless you and good night. Good night, Hank.